exalted on that day. And the idols shall utterly pass away, and people shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground from before the terror of the Lord, and from the splendor of his majesty, when he rises to terrify the earth. In that day mankind will cast away their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, to the moles and to the bats, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs, from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty, when he rises to terrify the earth. Stop regarding man, in whose nostrils is breath, for of what account is he?
Thanks, Brian, and welcome everyone. Well, we're going to be continuing our, this is the fourth of our a four-part series in these two chapters. The issue today, you'll see on the sheets there, the issue today is still, where is it all going? That was the issue last week as well. Where is it all going at the end of history? If you just flick back to chapter 2, verse 2, you will see those words there. It shall come to pass in the latter days. In other words, this whole chapter, Isaiah expands on the end. Where's it all going? Where is history going to end? And with events in the world as they are at the moment, we may well ask, as the fragile peace that seemed to be so stable creaks beneath our feet. That's why I think it's so refreshing to be where we are in Isaiah. Because Isaiah is pointing us towards the very end of human history. In these four talks, we've been looking at God's great plan for the universe. It's a plan that is beyond our imagination in scope. It's a plan that will affect every single person who's ever lived, whatever they believed, one way or another. The plans on Putin's desk, or on anyone else's desk for that matter, every CEO in the great buildings around us, those plans will all ultimately come to nothing. That's what we're going to see today. Only one plan will stand. And we've seen what it is in the last 3 weeks. We've seen that Isaiah, 700 years before the birth of Jesus Christ, God spoke through Isaiah to say, I will restore my people through refining judgment. I will burn away their sin, and I will establish them forever in a new Jerusalem. We saw last week the gates of this new Jerusalem will be flung open to the whole world. And in the last chapter of history, people from all over the world will flock to the God of the Jews and to his mountain. But there is another side to the same story that we must understand, and that is where Isaiah takes us today. That is that there is a day coming when God will humble proud humanity and will bring our long-standing rebellion to an end. Just have a look. I think you've got the summary there at the heart of our section in verses 9 to 11. I'm just going to read them. So man is humbled, each one is brought low. Do not forgive him. Enter into the rock, hide in the dust, from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low. The lofty pride of men shall be humbled. And the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. People sometimes say, don't they, something like, this is my day, this is my time. So the musician perhaps who's been waiting for years and then finally steps out onto the stage in Glastonbury, this is my day, this is my time. Well, just look down at verse 12. The Lord of hosts has a day. It will be his day. It will be his time. It will be, by default, the last day of history as we know it. It will be the last day of this age. but it will be the beginning of a new eternal age. The Lord of hosts has a day. It will be his day. It will be his time, because on that day, he will finally restore the honour that is due to him. You see, that's what's happening. He will bring to an end the rebellion that began right at the very beginning, Genesis chapter 2, when humanity lifted ourselves up against God and we said, we want to rule instead of God. Take this fruit and you will be like God. But there is a day coming, Isaiah says, when God will come back and say, you're not God, I am. This is not your world, it's mine. He will finally restore the honour of his name and bring to an end that rebellion that began in Genesis chapter 2. Make no mistake, Isaiah says, the trampling of God's name will not be allowed to continue forever. God has a day. And don't mistake his patience for impotence or non-existence. He will re-establish his total, uncontested rule and glory. Do you see that in verse 11? The end of verse 11? On that day, the Lord alone will be exalted. It will be his day. It will be his time. It will be the last day of this evil age. It will be the first day and the glorious eternal day of the new eternal age. Three things to say about this day on your sheets. There I've put, on God's day, all our achievements will be demolished, all our gods will be abandoned, and all those who've persisted in this rebellion will be left cowering before the God they thought so little of. Firstly, all our achievements will be demolished. That's verses 12 to 17. Extraordinary verses. The Lord of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up, and it shall be brought low, demolished, destroyed. Against all the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up, against the oaks of Bashan, against all the lofty mountains, against all the uplifted hills, against every high tower, every fortified wall, the ships of Tarshish, and against all the beautiful craft. What have we got here? What's he saying? Well, we've actually already seen this in 1 verse 31. Do you remember? All our work will be burnt up like a spark. And there are eight againsts here. The first four are against part of nature, and the second four are things we've built. What does God have against trees and mountains? It's puzzling, isn't it? Verse 13, the cedars of Lebanon against the lofty mountains. What does God have against trees that he made and mountains that he formed? It seems that these are symbols of how the world that God has made has been claimed, harnessed, and then boasted in by proud humanity. So the cedars of Lebanon were the great natural resources at which kingdoms could be built with. So Solomon built his kingdom with the cedars of Lebanon. Mountains are symbols, it seems, for the greatness of a land or a city. And it seems to be what God is saying here, the world that you think is yours, that you have claimed, harnessed, and boasted in as your own, well, I will bring it to an end. I will bring down the mountains you've boasted in. I will bring this whole world that you've claimed for yourself, I will bring it crashing down. Puts the Save the Planet environmental agenda into perspective, doesn't it? God says it won't ultimately achieve anything. This creation that we have claimed for ourselves, well, it will be brought down to nothing. From what we've claimed then to what we've made, and that's verses 15 and 16, against every high tower, every fortified wall, the ships of Tarshish, and beautiful craft. I think this is about human civilization. The whole of human civilization coming to nothing. That is, everything we've built, everything we've achieved, God says, will be wiped out. High towers have always been an expression of human ingenuity. They still are. We just need to look around the City of London and the global competition for high towers. The fortified wall of human strength. The ships of Tarshish were the most renowned trade ships in the Mediterranean. So they were used by Tyre and Sidon for at least 300 years. They carried great wealth. But they were also symbols of great human technological achievement. After all, they'd been being used for 300 years by Isaiah's time. They must have been reliable ships. They were very likely also beautifully made, technological and even artistic wonder. They therefore symbolized the ingenuity of man's creative power, his mastery over nature. In today's terms, they were the Lamborghini, the jumbo jet, the NASA rocket, the Tesla, the microchip. God says, on my day, I will bring all of the technological achievements of humanity to nothing. Isn't that extraordinary? It will all come to nothing. Not that God has anything against technological achievement in itself, but because it is a trophy of our rebellion, is it not? We boast in it. Aren't we great? Look at great humanity, what we've built, what we can do on our own without God. We don't need him. We're the masters of this world. We boast in our technological achievement. God says, therefore, I will bring it to nothing. Elon Musk, what an incredible, breathtaking ingenuity. God says, I will bring it to nothing. It won't stand. There won't be a Tesla left or a reusable rocket. It will all be wiped out. Think of all the laboratories, the hours in the laboratories, all the eureka moments, all the scientific discoveries. Extraordinary what God is saying here. I will bring it to nothing. The Lord has a day against the ships of Tarshish. But also notice there as well against the beautiful craft. Isn't that striking? It seems that even our art has become obnoxious to God. Not because God has anything against art per se. He made us creative. But because our art, like our technology, is one of our greatest boasts, isn't it? Look at what we can do without God. Aren't we great? Aren't we ingenious? Aren't we the rightful rulers of this planet? Isn't it extraordinary what God says in verse 16? I have a day against all the beautiful craft. The artistic triumphs of every culture will not be allowed to last into eternity. There will be no legacy. The great buildings, think of the Taj Mahal, the Kremlin, the Houses of Parliament, erased forever. Every great painting, think of the National Gallery, forgotten, gone. Every work of literature, Shakespeare, gone. Note, Isaiah does not deny it's beautiful, verse 16, against all the beautiful. It is beautiful. It will be gone, forgotten, pointless. God will bring it all to nothing. Not because he has anything against art. He made us creative. I take it that surely in the new Jerusalem, with the redeemed humanity, will be full of human creativity, done to the glory of God. Wonderful art, beyond our imagination. Technological advance for eternity. Imagine that. Extraordinary to explore the universe, the new universe that God is going to make for eternity. Think of the unlimited technological advance that the new, humble humanity will enjoy to the glory of God. But because the art of this age is a trophy of our proud rebellion, he will bring it to nothing. This is good news. It is actually obnoxious, isn't it? The way we boast in ourselves through our art, watching the Oscars or something like that. God has a day when he will bring it to an end. He will bring an end to our proud rebellion, because on that day it will be his day. Verse 11, he alone will be exalted. Secondly, our gods will be abandoned. Verse 18. The idols shall utterly pass away. The people shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth. In that day, mankind will cast away their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, to the moles and to the bats. What an extraordinary moment this will be, when finally all of the counterfeit gods that we have made for ourselves to worship, and that have been worshipped with such vigor and passion, no lack of zeal, whose books and principles we've made up, all of these gods will be tossed away for the moles and the bats, or in our language, for the rats and the pigeons. People will cry out, "Why did I ever trust in you, useless gods?" The atheist will throw away his useless atheism, which he has made up and worshipped as a god. When they face the true God, undeniably there in front of them in all his majesty, they will say, "Why did I ever believe in my atheism? You're useless to me." The agnostic will toss away the God of indecision. "Why did I ever believe in you?" The Muslim will throw away their Quran and ask, "Why did we ever trust in Muhammad's God?" The Buddhist, their golden statues. The Hindu, the Sikh, the list will go on and on. All of made-up human religion will be tossed aside on that day, on the day that the true God, the God of the Bible, comes to re-establish his honour and bring an end to all of human rebellion. Finally, all those who have persisted in their rebellion against him will cower before the God they thought so little of. We get that three times, don't we? Verse 10, enter into the rock and hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. Verse 19, the people shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. Verse 21, it's as if Isaiah is saying, "I know that you don't believe this is actually going to happen, so I'm going to say it three times. When the Lord comes, they will cower because it is terrifying." You get that phrase, from before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. Now, whether we are Christian or not, if we think we have the first idea of what it will be like for the God who made the universe to come back in all his unfiltered glory, think of Isaiah a few chapters later. He sees the hem of the robe of God and cries out, "Woe is me." The known universe is 93 billion light years across. Unimaginable distances, we can't conceive of it. We can barely even conceive of the size of the sun. This is the universe that God says he stretched out with a span of his hand. What will it be like for him to come here in all his unfiltered glory? All the bravado and bluster of man will be gone. No one's even begun to have the slightest inkling of what it will be like to face God. All those who have persisted in their rebellion against him will be left cowering before the God they thought so little of, humbled utterly before him. In the New Testament, it becomes clear that this is actually the day that Jesus returns. Jesus talks about the day when he will come in all the glory of his Father. Paul talks about the day of Christ when Jesus will come back in person to judge. The book of Revelation opens with these famous words, "Behold, he," that is Jesus, "is coming. Every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn on account of him. Even so, amen." It will be Jesus who will rise to terrify the earth. Do you realize that? Fully God, God the Son. And therefore it will be Jesus before whom the whole of rebellious humanity will abandon their idols and surrender. What should we conclude? Well, we get the implication there in verse 22. "Stop regarding man in whose nostrils is breath. Of what account is he?" It's mainly a negative lesson from these verses. Literally there, cease from man. Stop trusting in him. Stop fearing him. Stop regarding him. I like the way one writer puts it. Be done with man in whose nostrils is breath. He is supported by nothing more than air. He's made up of air. What can he do for you or against you? He is of no account. That's the point. So therefore, be done with trusting in his riches. You guys are, you know, surrounded by the sparkling career. The sparkling career that will fill your bank accounts with money that cannot help you. Be done with man and his riches. Be done with his chariots, verse 7. Be done with the strength and the power, the apparent military power of man. There is no salvation in NATO. The West will be humbled, just like the East. Be done with it. Be done with his technological ingenuity. There is no salvation in medical science. It can delay death like a few chariots. That's all. That's all medical science can do. Be done with it, trusting in it for salvation. Be done with man and his gods, verse 8. There is no salvation in atheism, humanism, agnosticism, mindfulness, Buddhism, Islam. The list goes on. It's all bluster. It will be worshipped passionately and then abandoned when the Lord Jesus returns. You see that? It won't be abandoned until that day. It will be worshipped passionately and then abandoned. You might put it like this. The kingdom of man seems so powerful, so beautiful, doesn't it? So full of hope. But in the words of one Christian writer, it is resting precariously on a spider's web over a massive precipice. That is the kingdom of man. These great buildings in the city, these towers. I was in the pub last night with a friend, a nice pub in Bermondsey. And I had these verses in mind though. I was listening to him, but I also looking at the table in front of me and thinking, it'll all be gone. Go back to your office, tap the table, it'll be gone. The kingdom of man resting precariously on a spider's web. He is of no account. There is no salvation in him. Who is of account is God. He's the one we should fear. He's coming back. He's the one whose city will stand triumphant on that last day, the New Jerusalem. There won't be anywhere else that's safe on that last day. There will only be one place that is safe in eternity, and that is to be one of God's washed, redeemed, forgiven people through the blood of Jesus in the New Jerusalem. So Isaiah says, be done with man, invest all your hope in God and his wonderful promises.